friend, Malcolm Margolin. He is a publisher of Heyday Books. Has won many awards for his literary accomplishments. He wrote a book called The Ohlone Way, which is probably the Bible of understanding what kind of life went on here in Northern California before the Caucasians, before the Europeans arrived. A wonderful book. And I asked Malcolm to come last year, and he was dearly loved, and so we asked him back again to offer whatever wisdom he may want to offer us. I'm just delighted to have you here and to have you willing to do this, because it's a real special offering that you make to those of us out here. We're calling this a nature retreat, but we kind of found our
lots of luck.
Exactly. Nature's not cooperating. That's the problem. We should have made an agreement before we started. So, what is your pleasure to address as a topic?
Well, can people hear me? Am I all hooked up? Why don't I just do what I do, which is just to ramble around and hope that somebody finds something of value in it, and
okay.
Eventually you tell me to stop.
Okay, when it's time to stop, I'll ring the bell as the hook, you know, to pull you off.
Yeah, do that. And it's lovely being here, and it's a special place. What do you call that hall down there?
Yeah, meditation.
Is the most beautiful space that I've ever seen in my whole life. I mean, I just walked in; it was utterly stunning, and you just feel yourself expanding into it. It was just beautiful. I'm a publisher. We do about 20 or so books a year. We run a couple of hundred events. I was explaining to my friend Scoop that it's just pure luck. I mean, that I end up seeing myself on the banks of this river of beauty that flows through the place. I stand there, people bring me the most beautiful thoughts and manuscripts and ideas and images and words. And I just stand at this river of beauty and I dip in a ladle and I pull things out and I call them books. And it's been an absolutely marvelous life that I've been leading. And among the things that have been flowing down that river is my involvement with California Indians and California Indian world. And I grew up in Boston. I'm clearly not an Indian. I came to California in a VW bus in the late 60s. I just kind of bumbled into this world accidentally. And it's been the most amazing gift of all the gifts that life has given me. This sense of an older California, the sense of people with their contemporary struggles, with their diverse personalities, with their histories, with their tragedies, with this deep sadness, with this deep beauty that flows through this place. It's just been an honor to be a witness to this. I've been witnessing it now for 35 or so years, and I'm just deeply moved by what I've seen and the change of generations and its connection to thought and language and land and history. And just very briefly, there was such diversity here, and there still is. There were 100 different languages spoken in California. Each tribe had its own little land base. It had its own language. It had its customs. People living in wooden houses up on the Klamath River, in underground houses in the Sacramento Valley, in tule houses around here. People living in big villages of 100, of 1,000 people in some places. In other places, people living in small clans. Just a marvelous sense. We have this sense of culture that things come together. We live in a technological age where things are merging. But back then, things were dispersed. I remember there was an old friend of mine, Bun Lucas, was this old man who was born up in Cushaia Reservation, up in Sonoma County. And I once got him a job at the linguistics department at Cal, teaching students how to interview somebody that had an obscure language, and from those interviews, how to create a sound system and a grammar and a vocabulary. And I bring Bun, and Bun would come from Sonoma. He'd come over to my house. It was the only place he knew how to get to in Berkeley. And I find him sitting out in front of my house in his car reading the National Enquirer and learning all about crop circles and aliens. And then we'd go off to the linguistics department and we'd talk about Indian stuff. And I remember there was one time where there was a word, there were six different guttural sounds in Kashaya Pomo. The and there were different guttural sounds, and he was trying to explain that there was a particular word that was akha. And the students would go, akha. And he'd go, no, 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 akha. And the students would go, akha. And they'd go, no, 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 akha. No, 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 you can't say it that way, akha. So finally they got it. And then he said, but that's not how my Uncle Herman said it. Uncle Herman lived in Rockpile. Herman said it, akha. So they finally got that. They said, that's not how my Aunt Gladys said it. And you realize this little tribe of 500 people had all these different people with their own dialects coming from different places. And there was a love and a pride in diversity, a pride in who you were, how you were attached to a particular place, how you were attached to the people in your place. And there was just such a deep sense of love and affection. I remember old Essie Parrish talking about tan bark oak. I mean, we call this thing the tan bark oak, such an ugly name. And she, and in her language, it was shishkale, beautiful tree. And she would talk about shishkale, beautiful tree. And wherever I would go, she would say, and I would see shishkale, I knew that Worldmaker had been there. And I knew that I would do well in my healing because this was a beautiful tree and this was a beautiful place. And it was said with such emotion and such depth of affection. The this Indian world and the Buddhist worlds don't usually mix. Just historically, they've been apart, but there was one notable exception. That was Harry Roberts. Did you know Harry Roberts? Harry Roberts lived over at the Zen Center in Green Gulch. He was an old guy by the time I got here. And he had grown up in, he was a white guy. He grew up in Rekwa at the mouth of the Klamath River. And Rekwa was this old Yurok town, this township over there. And there was a it was a center of Yurok culture, of Yurok Indian culture. There were people in there that sang the songs that brought the salmon into the Klamath River and up the stream. It was Murky Oliver's family. And there was a house there, the house of Wogwu, which was the ruling house of the Yurok world. And Robert Spott was the grand culture bearer. Back in the 20s, Kroeber was, he was the one that taught Alfred Kroeber about Yurok life. And Harry Roberts grew up with Robert Spott as a teacher. And he once told this beautiful story about how he grew up in there and they have brush dance, which is a healing dance. And it's done in a pit. And it's done at night. And you stand around the pit and the dancers are in this pit. And you look down upon them, and it's dark, and this dance goes on all night, and it's for healing the sick, and sometimes healing, usually for healing sick individuals. Sometimes it goes a little bit beyond that. And he was watching Robert Spott, his uncle, make the feather headdresses for this healing ceremony. And he was taking these feathers, and he was bending them over, and he was sewing them deeply, and sewing them intricately, and bending them, and finally, young Harry says, why are you doing it so carefully? You fold the feathers over. Nobody can see the stitch. It's nighttime. Nobody can see anything. Why are you doing it that way? And Robert Spott says, I thought you knew better. Think about it. So Harry was shocked at this and went off and thought about it. And the next day, Robert Spott looks at him and says, you were wondering about those feathers. Let me tell you about brush dance. Let me tell you about how the divinities gave us brush dance and why they had to give us brush dance. And then the next day, he looks at Harry and he says, are you still thinking about it? And Harry says, yeah. And he says, let me tell you about feathers. Let me tell you why feathers have power. Let me tell you how the birds gave themselves over to us so we could do brush dance. Then the next day, he looks at Harry and he says, you still thinking about it? Harry says, yeah. He says, let me tell you about what, he says, there was a time when the missionaries came and they stopped the brush dancers and we had to revive them. Let me explain how they revived them. And every day there was a number of stories. And finally, after several days, Harry realizes he understands why it has to be done this way, why the feathers have to be sewn so carefully, even though nobody can see them. And I was telling this, I had a wonderful friend, David Perry. We did some magazines and some books together once. He was a Bodega Miwok guy. And I was talking to him about it, and he says, that's pure Indian pedagogy. I said, Indian pedagogy? Who knew? And he says, yeah, he says, this is Indian pedagogy. There's a sense in there that if you teach somebody something, you've robbed them of the capacity to learn it. That what you do is you set things up so somebody learns within that setup. You don't teach them, you allow them to learn. And that's a deeper kind of knowledge. And there was something in that that I thought was so wondrous and so beautiful. And I thought that I was wondering what I would do here today. And I thought that maybe I would talk about Indian pedagogy, about how people learn, about the way things are learned. And I really hope this is, I'm sure it'll be entertaining. I hope it's valuable. I mean, you're here for good reason, and I hope to add to it.
That's wonderful, my Malcolm, if I can just cut in for a second and let you know that that's exactly what we're talking about today in the group, is a different way of learning. So,
yeah, there was a different way of learning. There was a consciousness to it. There was a thoughtfulness to it. When I went and I saw that beautiful hall over there, it reminded me of those Indian roundhouses that used to be in California. And they were smaller than that, but they were underground, and then there was a roof built over them, and there was an entrance, and it was dark. And when you'd go in them, there'd be a smoke hole. And when you'd go in them, it was as if, and they'd light the fire, and the dancers would begin, and the drummer beats there's a floor drum, and they have a big pole, a big stick, and they bang on the floor drum, and they create this echoing rhythm, and the singers begin to sing, and the dancers come bending in through the door, and they dance around, and the fire throws their shadows up on the ceiling. And you feel, once those dances begin, some of them will go on for 4 nights, where they still do them up in the Central Valley. And you feel that you've been there for your entire, that this is the center of the world, that this is where things have always been. And the rest of your life is just some kind of a temporary dream, that this is the place where things have always existed and have always been. And there were roundhouses throughout all of California, throughout Central California. And there was a roundhouse culture. There were universities, there were churches, there were sanctuaries, there were community halls. Every big village had one. And they existed right through to the 1930s. They were active, each had a dance troupe, they had storytellers, they had singers. And there was some great ones over by Ione and Buena Vista on the way to the foothills. And there was this guy, Bill Franklin. He was Sierra Miwok. And he was a dancer as a young man. He was a dancer in the wonderful roundhouse of Ione. And people, when I first got into this kind of thing in the late 70s, in the mid-70s, people would still talk about that roundhouse at Ione. They talk about Pedro Connor giving these grand stories. They talked about it as if it was Yale or as if it was Oxford, as a center of learning, as a center of culture. And Bill Franklin was a young man. He was dancing in the Ione Roundhouse. And then came the Second World War, and Bill went into the war. And when he came back, the roof had collapsed, and the roundhouse was disused. And an older generation had died, and younger people had moved to the city. There were now jobs, so people could get jobs in the shipyards and places. And he came back, and the roundhouse was gone. He went to Buena Vista, that roundhouse was gone. He went to Jackson, that roundhouse was gone. There was just a sudden collapse of this whole culture. And he did what people do, what young Indians did at that time, which is he went out, he got a job in logging, he got married, he built a little house in Shingle Springs, he started raising a family. And it got to be the 50s and it got to be the 60s. And one day he looked around, he realized it was gone. That whole old world was gone. So he built a rec room next to his house, and he got his kids together. And they go out and they find roadkill of animals to reconstruct the regalia. And he taught them the songs. And they reconstructed the dances and the songs in his rec room. And then he got together in the late 60s, about 68 or 69, he got together with a guy named Glenn Villa and Old Man Burris and a few other of these old-timers that remembered the old roundhouse, and they decided to rebuild a roundhouse. And they built a roundhouse up in Grinding Rock State Park. They wanted a state park. They didn't want it on Indian land, because if it was on Indian land, it would belong to a particular tribe. So they've got this state park land, and they built this roundhouse at Chausse at Grinding Rock State Park. And they constructed this beautiful old roundhouse, and it lasted until, for about 20 years, it lasted until 1990, and the roof collapsed. Then they rebuilt the roof, and it's still going strong. And every year there's events and there's ceremonies. I've been going to this thing for now for 30-odd years. And it's like Woodstock. I mean, you have the most wonderful singers and dancers come there, and people come in and bless their kids, and you'll be there. Communities that have lost their roundhouse, they'll come in at 2 o'clock in the morning to commemorate the dead and to do various things. And one day I was over there, and I was talking to some guy named Dwight Dutschke, who was Burris's grandson, and we were talking about how the roundhouse had been built. And I was wondering about the construction of the roundhouse, how the door was oriented, how the posts were set, how the there was a back door, and I was wondering whether the back door dated to the old days or whether it was added for code violations because it was a state park. And I was asking him how it was built, and Dwight looks at me and he says, "I know what you're getting at." I said, what am I getting at? He says, "You're getting at the fact that we didn't build it too good." I said, "No, Dwight. No, that wasn't it at all." He says, "Well, we didn't build it too good." He says, "We're into construction. We know how to build things. We know you don't stick posts in the ground without creosote, without drainage. There was nothing in the old rules that said we couldn't use creosote. We know that you don't bind the rafters with grapevine, that they're not going to last. We could have used metal. There was nothing in the old laws that said we couldn't use metal. But there was something that we had to follow. There was a law we had to follow." And I said, "What was that?" And he said, "We had to build a roundhouse so that every 20 years it falls apart. That way every generation knows how to rebuild it." There was a consciousness. And what he said was, if you want to build a roundhouse that lasts 100 years, we know how to do that. What we're trying to do is build a culture that lasts 100 years, and that's how we do it. And it was somehow or other, it was a day before there was print, before there was media, that in order to make something last, in order to make knowledge last, it had to be practiced, it had to be passed on. It couldn't be written down. And in an age when you couldn't write things down, there were interesting ways of keeping knowledge. I remember there was a canoe, a guy building dugout canoes up in the Klamath River. And I was once visiting him, and he was carving out the dugout canoe. And as he was carving it out, a big piece of redwood, and as he was carving it out, he was kind of tapping the side of it. And at first I thought he was palsy. There was this kind of nervous tap that he was making on the side of it, like his hand was unsteady. But I realized it was deliberate, and I asked him what he was doing. And what he was doing was listening to the song that the canoe sang, that as you tap it out, there was a tune. He would wait until he got the right tune. And when that right song came, he knew that he got it right. They didn't have calipers to measure the thickness of the wall. And it was, and the blueprint of the canoe was encoded in a song that the canoe would sing as you tapped it. There was down in Southern California, among the down toward Riverside and throughout all of Southern California, there were people that sang these bird songs. And the bird songs were absolutely wonderful. They went on for 4 nights straight. And they could only be sung in wintertime, when the nights were longest. And for 4 nights, you'd sing these linked verses. One would lead to another, one to another, one to another. And it went on for 4 long nights, and it recounted the wanderings of divinities over the world when the world was first created. And it was people, it was world maker and coyote and first man, and they were looking for the best place for people to live. And it's the recounting of how they went here and they did this, they went there and they did this, they went there. And it sanctifies the landscape. It gives the landscape meaning. And I remember there was one friend of mine, Preston Arrowweed, who's Kachan from the Colorado River, and he's a bird singer. He was talking about how the divinities came down the Colorado River, and then there was, you could follow the songs down the Colorado River, and then there was one place where they went west for about 5 miles, left the river, then they went south for a couple of miles, and then they came back and they rejoined the river. And he always wondered, what in the world were the divinities doing that for? Why didn't they just follow the river? And then he was once out with some archaeologists, and they pointed to the fact that this was where the channel of the Colorado River had once been. And the river had changed its channel, but the songs retained the memory of that old channel. And they've been singing these songs. There are still people that sing them. Now, this is too long. I mean, this. You just break your heart. I mean, the songs, when they're sung, there's gourd rattles and dances come out in front, and each verse is sung. And I once thought that if there's a heaven and I go to that place and I come to a room and there's nothing but Elvino Siva and Roberto Livi and Bic Andrea singing bird songs for eternity, that's the eternity that I want to spend, is just listening to these bird songs. And there was a guy, my friend Ernie Siva, he's Serrano, and he was singing some bird songs, and I once asked him, he sang a verse, and I said, what does that mean? And it was a verse in Serrano language, and he says, if you want to know the meaning of the words, I'll tell you the meaning of the words. But that's not necessarily what the song means. What gives the song its meaning is not just its words. It's who taught it to me. It's who I'm going to teach it to. It's when we've sung it. Did we sing it at somebody's funeral? Did we sing it at a particular place? That all the things we do give the song its meaning. And it was the most wonderful thing about this Indian knowledge. It's not like isolated facts. We have this sense that there are things called facts, that they exist in and of themselves. And this fact, if I know it, or if Scoop knows it, or if you know it, is the same kind of fact. But there, these facts take on the coloration of who you learned it from, of who you're going to teach it to, of what happened to it. That the facts are emotional, the facts are connected. The facts aren't rigid little unchanging things. I'm not sure I'm getting the right spin on this, but There's something about the life of the fact. It's a world of connections, and it's a world of strategies in how to teach people things and how to let people learn. There was a sense of initiation. There was a sense that young people and older people learn differently. And when you teach a young person something, they learn it one way, and then there's often an initiation, and then other truths are revealed. I remember there was a Hopi guy, Emery Sekakwaptur. And Emery Sekakwaptur grew up in the Hopi mesas. And he talked about how when he was a kid, the kachinas would come out of the kivas, and they do these dance, and these were supposedly gods. These were the divinities. These were the gods that had come down from the San Francisco mountains. And they were dancing, and they come out of the kivas, and they dance in the villages. And then you'd look at them, and these were the gods. And he remembered one time when you were bad, there was one of these divinities that was called the Soya. And it was this monstrous, this ogre, and it would catch little kids who had been bad, and it would punish them. And he talked about how he was once in his, he'd done something awful, whatever it may have been. And he was in his house, and there's a knock at the door, and it's the Soya has come to get him. And the grandmother opens the door, and the Soya is there. And Emery's shaking in his boots. He's hiding in the back room. And the grandmother deals with the Soya. She bribes him. She gives him some food. She gives him something. And the Soya goes away, and the grandmother says, don't you ever do this again, because I've only got one shot with the Soya. And there was this sense of awesomeness, this sense of the divine powers of these dancing gods that came into the village. And then when his initiation comes, he talked about being brought into the kiva. And then they were sitting with all the kids in the kiva. They were being lectured to. These kivas were underground houses in Hopi Mesa. And he was being lectured to. And now and the kachina dancers were going out. And the kachinas now came down the ladder into the kiva. And they took off their masks. And he looked, and there were all the people he knew, his friends, fathers, the uncles. They were people. And he talked about this sense of immense betrayal, that suddenly the whole damn thing was a fraud. The whole thing was just a show, that there were no gods, that these were just the people he knew. And he felt so bereft of magic. And he talked about how the world became monochromatic. He lost his sense of color. He just sat there glazed and stunned and shocked. And then several days went by, and finally the head of the kiva comes and says, "You've now learned that these gods are people. What you're now going to learn is the next lesson, that when we put on the masks of the gods, we become godlike." And there was something about taking the knowledge that a kid can learn and leading them through a process by which they learn more and more important things. In our culture, we're lousy with knowledge. I mean, we have Google, we have computers, we have everything is all available, everything is all accessible. Back then, there was restraint. Only certain people could sing songs. Songs could only be sung during the wintertime. Tales could only be told under certain conditions. The rarity of it set it off and made it special. And there was something about that restraint that was so built into the way in which you would see things. And another quality, there was a wonderful old alcoholic linguist that lived in Berkeley, Jaime de Angulo. He was a Spaniard, and he studied California Indian languages. And he was once talking about being up in Pitt River country, that lofty, lonely country between Redding and Alturas. And he was interviewing some old guy over there. And he said to the guy, he says, "Tell me about the creation of the world. Tell me how the world was made." And the Indian says, "Well, in the beginning was Silver Fox made the world." And Jaime says, "Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You say it was Silver Fox. Down that town over there, they tell me it was Coyote made the world." And the Indian says, "Well," he says, "there they say it was Coyote. Here we say it was Silver Fox." And he went on with the story. In Europe, you would have had a religious warfare in which 300,000 people would have been killed until you discovered the true meaning, who is the true maker of the world. Up there, you have each tribe has a center of the world. The Hupa have Tlacomildig, the Yurok have Kinnek, the Karuk have Katamin. Each have their center of the world. They come and they dance at each other's center of the world. How can there be three centers of the world? There was a time, as Jaime was asking this guy to tell the story of the creation, the guy comes to something that Silver Fox is about to do something. And then he says, "I better not do that, because what will people think if I do that?" And Jaime says, "Whoa, what do you mean, what will people think if I do that? There's no people. It's the creation. You can create any world you want. I mean, what do you mean, what will people think?" And the Indian says, "You know," he says, "when I was a kid, I wondered about that. And I asked my father." And my father said, "You know, when I was a kid, I wondered about that." And there was something about this indeterminacy. There was something about the feeling that you get is the world is more complex and full of mystery than the human intelligence can comprehend. And you have an allowance for mystery in the world. You have an allowance for the fact that things aren't, that everything isn't knowable, that there are certain things that aren't knowable. So you do the best you can. You put out ideas, but what you are up against is the bigger mystery of the world that is beyond human comprehension. And it's to be experienced, those big head dances that they do in the Central Valley. I was talking to some guy was a dancer. And I said, and when I was talking about what do the dancers mean? He says, "I'm not sure." He says, but what I know is when I dance the big head dance, it puts my head in the big way. Isn't that great? I mean, you know the experience. It's not necessarily verbalized. It's in the experience. And the experience is savored.
Malcolm, that's beautiful. I just love what you've been saying. But I'm wondering if maybe sometime, you go on if there's a point that you want to finish, but that maybe we could open it up for a question or two.
Yeah, well, let me make, there's one other point.
Sure.
There were actually several different points that can be made. Let me go to, there are several different points that could be made. And one of them is what it is like to be living in a living universe in which everything around you has intelligence and power and the capacity to teach. That the stories of rocks that were people in a previous world, of birds and animals that were people in a previous world, that you walk around in the world, it tells you stories. It's a moral universe. It teaches you things. You're forever going out into the world and being reminded of moral lessons. And the one other thing that I want to say that I think is relevant, there was a Hooper friend of mine, Jack Norton, and Jack Norton was in some kind of a messy divorce with Marceline, and he was depressed, and he went off from Hooper Reservation, he went off to the river, to the Trinity River, and he went up a creek that was called Tully Creek. And he was up in Tully Creek, and he was sitting by the creek, and he'd fasted for several days. He hadn't been able to eat. He was miserable. And all he's sitting there, and suddenly the creek sings him a song. And he gives him a song. And he goes back to Hooper, and there was this wonderful man, Rudolf Soktisch, was alive back then. And he comes up to Rudolf, and he says, Rudolf, he says, I was up by that creek they call Tully Creek, and the creek sung me a song. And Rudolf says, what song did it sing? And Jack sings the song. And Rudolf goes, oh, that's Wally's old song. Wally died. I was wondering what happened to that song. Jack goes, well, the creek gave it to me. And he says, well, I guess it's yours, he says, because sometimes songs do that. They give themselves over to creeks to hold them for a while, and then you come and you get it from the creek. There's something in there there's something in there that's important. And it's an attitude. We're an aggressive society. We go out and we get knowledge. We take things. Things are ours to grasp. We're told that if we expend effort, we can get what we want in this world. Back then, the world gave you things. That if you would go out there and you would prepare yourself at the right time, if you were lucky, you'd be out in the world. And if you were in the right time, you would get a vision. You would get a truth. The world would give you something. And it was that sort of sense, that respect for a world that's bigger than our consciousness, that's bigger than our powers, where you would go out there and get yourself ready and hope that if you were lucky, the world would give you something. And I think that's important. I think I hope you all get lucky. In effect, you rang the bell.
No, I didn't. I didn't ring the bell. I don't want the bell to be rung.
No, that's okay. Do people have questions and discussions? Yes, sir.
I want to say a little bit about this area right here and the Alonis, or the way of life that existed here before Anglos came onto the scene.
Yeah, they were Coast Miwok people here. The Alonis, they were Coast Miwok people here. In this area, they spoke one dialect of Coast Miwok. Toward Bodega, they spoke another dialect of Coast Miwok. Up north, there was the southern Pomo that spoke a Pomo language. Across the from the Golden Gate with the Ramaytush and Ohlone people that spoke a language. The Tamian down south, the Chechenyo in the East Bay, the Kakin and the Kakina Straits, the Patuan up toward Benicia, all these little pockets of people that lived around. And the, let's see, what do we say about the people that lived here? They lived in small villages. They lived, a lot of these villages were along Tamales Bay. Toward Point Reyes. There were villages throughout. There was a village up in Olampoli. There were villages throughout the area. These villages were maybe like 50, 60, 70 people. Small villages. People would end up clustering during the wintertime around the village, and then during the spring and the summer, they'd disperse out into the land, and they'd gather and they'd hunt, and they'd come back together again for the winter. There were tule houses, reed houses. There were round houses, underground houses here. There was a... each village had a chief, and there was a... this was unusual, but there was a... Gee, I hope I got this straight. There was like a committee of ruling class women that would choose the chief. And the chief was male, but there was these ruling class women that would choose the chief. It must have been like my Aunt Ira. But the chief didn't have any power. I mean, to be a chief was not the biggest deal in the world. It ran by consensus. You lived in these small villages here. You would know everybody. You would never see a stranger. Maybe in your entire life, you would very rarely see a stranger. You would you knew everybody. You knew their parents. You knew their you knew who they were. You knew their history. You couldn't get away from them. To find marriage partners, you'd end up having to bring somebody in from a distant place because you were related to everybody. You were never alone. To be alone was an experience, that the women would always sit there together and cook together and gather food together and talk together. They'd make basket together. They'd raise kids together. Nobody had a private room. It was a slow world. It was an amazingly slow world. There was a linguist that once recorded a couple of old women talking. And the linguist wanted the linguist wanted to get them to talk. She felt that she was asking somebody directly to say something, and the person was talking to her. She was wondering what would happen if two people talked to one another. So there were these two old ladies, Lizzie and Rose. And she asked them, she says, why don't you talk to each other? And they said, what should we talk about? She says, talk about how you made baskets. And Lizzie says, oh, yes, she says, we made baskets. And Rose said, we did make baskets. Lizzie says, yes, she wants us to talk about the baskets we made. And Rose is saying, yes, we're going to talk about baskets. We did make baskets. Yes, we would sit around, we would make baskets. Everybody made baskets. Yes, we made baskets. And I'm reading this and I'm just going nuts. And I realize these people have all the time in the world. And they're weaving the conversation. It's like a basket. It's repetition and pattern. And they're sitting together and they're just making sounds at one another that have this pattern that builds up. It was a world rich in wildlife. There were grizzly bears. There were herds of pronghorn and elk and condors. There's the most amazing condor cape that's in Russia. When the Russians came down from this area, they collected a condor cape of condor feathers, and they brought it back to St. Petersburg, and it's awesome. It's a glistening black power that this has. They still celebrate here Strawberry Festival. And I was once with some guy up in the hills not far from here, and we were talking, and it was springtime, and there were elderberries blossoming. And the elderberries blossom with this wonderful thick blossom. It just smells so good. It's just so thick. It fills the air with sweetness. And I said, God, I said, isn't it beautiful when these elderberries blossom? And he said, yes, but it makes me sad. And I said, why is that? And he says, because when the elderberries blossom, it means we can't go down to the ocean and get shellfish. I said, oh. So that's how you know. When do you know you can go there? And he says, when the berry comes out, it tells us we can go there. And it hooked me into the fact that there were these phenomenological calendars around here. That the strawberry festival, when the strawberries ripened, the day was marked, there'd be a ceremony. They still do strawberry festival in Point Reyes. And this would be a marker. And then 4 days later, the brobidea bulbs would ripen on a particular hill, and you'd know you could get those. And then something else would happen, and something else would happen. And every community had these linked events that defined the calendar for that community. It was intensely local. It was intensely local. There was the last speaker of the language is being relearned. And and there are now people speaking the language more than there were 20 years ago. But when I first got into this, there was one speaker left, Mrs. Ballard. And Mrs. Ballard, and there was a linguist, Catherine Callahan, came in to talk to her to get the last of the language, to get the last, squeeze out the last few words, check on the grammar, get this last speaker to give what this language had to offer. And the linguist is looking at Catherine Callan is looking at Mrs. Ballard, and one day Mrs. Ballard says, there's a word that has been going through my mind now for days, and I can't remember what it means. And it was a word, something like plechta. She said, can you tell me what that word means? And Catherine Callahan goes back to the dictionaries that had been collected and the words that had been collected, and she comes back to Mrs. Ballard, and she says, it sounds like the second person preterite interrogative of the verb to urinate. So Mrs. Ballard says, huh? And the linguist says, I think it means, did you pee? And Mrs. Ballard looks and she says, oh, that's right. Every night my grandmother would tuck me into bed and she'd say, plechta.
I have a question, Malcolm. Was there a general belief or in the cosmology of the natives that lived around here of what happens after death? What happens to the individual? Was it an individual soul that something was resolved? Or?
When a person died, which people tended to do, when a person died, there was a mixture of feeling, and it was a small village. People knew each other really well. They knew each other with a depth and with great intimacy, and people were connected in ways that I think we can only imagine. When somebody died, there was both the sense of deep mourning. People would put ashes on their face, they'd cut their hair, they'd fast. There was true misery. And there was also fear. There was fear that the ghost would be around, that the ghost would cause problems, that the spirit would be unhappy. And a lot of the prayers were, go where you are going, don't look back. There was an afterworld where people would go. I heard down at Point Conception near Santa Barbara, there was this guy, a friend that I had, Tony Romero. He lived up in the Santa Ynez Reservation. And we were once sitting there on the Santa Ynez Reservation and we were looking at the sky, there were stars. And he says, did you ever notice how every so often the stars dim? And I said, yeah, kind of. He says, you know what that is? And I said, no. He says, that's the souls of the dead heading off to Point Conception. And I said, well, what happens to them? He says, well, they go off to Point Conception, and there's a cliff. And they go down the cliff, and before you reach the water, there's a pool. And there are two divinities at the pool. And when the spirit comes down, they pluck out the eyes of the spirit. They put in petals of poppy. And the spirit can now go back to the place where it had lived. and for 4 days it can revisit the place where it lived, and through the petals of poppy it can see the truth of its life. 4 days later it comes back to the cliff, it comes down to the pool, the petals are taken out, discs of abalone are put in, and the spirit is sent off to the islands to the west where it dances, the dances that go on. And through the abalone, it now sees the truth of the eternal world. There was a sense of an afterworld. There was a sense of an afterlife. There was a sense but you know, it may be that I just don't understand it. But it didn't have the sharp definition that it has in Christianity. It didn't have the sharp sense of angels or anything like that. It was a kind of dimly understood world of people dancing and spirits being there. There was a sense of it being a sad world. There was a greater tolerance for sadness in the Indian world than we have in our world. I mean, we live in a world in which we're supposed to be happy, 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 happy all the time. There was a sense of... there was a lot of joking, there was a lot of happiness. People ask me why I keep hanging around Indians, and I often say it's for the laughter. They're funny. But there was also a sense that afterworld was... sad, I guess. I don't know. There was not a sense of rewards that I ever came upon, that if you led a good life, you would go to a good place, and if you led a bad life, you'd go to a bad place. There was not a sense of reincarnation or transmigration. There was a sense that you didn't, among many tribes, you couldn't speak the name of the person that had died, because that would bring the person back. You couldn't, you tried not to think about that person. You burned the person's goods, that the baskets that the person had made, the implements that the person had used would be destroyed. And it had to do with, it again has to do with the emotional, personal characterization of the qualities of that world. That we now live in things that are, we have things that were bought in stores. I mean, the clothes that I'm wearing were bought in a store. There, everything had history. Everything belonged to a person. It was made by somebody. You knew who it was. That person's baskets were that person's baskets. They weren't baskets in the abstract. They were baskets that belonged to somebody. And the person would be attached to them in some way, and you'd put the baskets, you'd burn them, you'd put the baskets into the grave with the person. One of the most beautiful things that I ever heard was, we were once part of the creation of this California Indian Basket Weavers Conference, and there were these basket weavers from all over the state who had been getting together now for the last 20 years, and there was one basket conference where I was standing there with a basket weaver, Julia Parker, who's just a wonderful weaver and a dear friend. Funny stories about Julia. And I'm standing there with Julia, and we're looking over at the basket weavers, and there I'm looking, and there's this generation of weavers. There's Vivian Hailstone and Georgina Troll and Eileen Figueroa and Norma Turner and all these great weavers from around the states, from around the state. And I look at Julia and I say, "Look who's here, Julia. Basketry attracts the best people in the world, doesn't it?" And she says, "No, Malcolm, you don't understand. It's the baskets that make us this way." And it's the sense that the baskets make the people, that by involving us, by giving yourself over to this creation of beauty, you end up getting this gift of beauty from it. And there was this sense of gathering the plants, that the plants wanted to be gathered, to be fulfilled. There were stories about how the plants needed human beings to gather them and to create this beauty, to fulfill the plant's destiny. It wasn't as if we, once again, have this sense that we're taking things from the world. There was this sense that people in the world were working together to create a beautiful world. the great world renewal dances. People's, you go up to Hoopa Reservation or up to the Karuk country or up to Klamath River or up to Tolowa country, and people do these world renewal dances every year. They go on for 10 days, and it's 10 days of dancing the world back into shape, back into rhythm. And I brought various of my kids up there, and I remember there was one time where the kids were up there, and I've heard the expression to die of boredom, but I thought that I was literally going to lose one of them. I mean, it was the same dance done again and again for 10 days with slight variations. And it's getting rid of variety. It's getting down to the basic rhythms of the world. It's dancing yourself into harmony with the world. It's, I think boredom is part of religion. I mean, I think that it's necessarily... I remember being in synagogues when I was a kid. I was bored out of my wits.
Meditators, take note. Boredom is part of, yes.
Yeah, it's part of the whole thing. And but what they're doing is they're dancing. It's people's work is to dance the world into harmony again, that every 2 years you do world renewal. And it was so wonderful to be part of something in which human beings had a... I mean, we tend to think of human beings as being a cancer in this world, that we're destructive, we're screwing everything up, we're wrecking everything. But there was this sense of people as necessary to the harmony of the world. And it was just so beautiful to come upon that and to feel about this noble quest of people, that we have a job to do. And we do have a job to do. We're not doing it, but we do have a job to do.
How do we do that dance that brings the world back into shape?
Hey, you're the teacher. that's your job. I'm just a guest. Let's see, how do we do it? God, I don't know. I don't know.
You had a question?
Yeah, there? How about engagement with the rest of the world over the last many decades? For example, with making and selling baskets, what has been preserved that way? What has been lost? What has been changed? And how do the people feel about it?
Oh, what a wonderful question. You know, change happens. I mean, change always happens. It's not as if there was this static world and then whites came along and everything. I mean, things did change. It was cataclysmic. But change has always been here. And things changed within baskets. Things changed that this making of... Baskets used to be pots and pans. They used to be... hampers. It used to be, and along came a pot that you could buy for a small amount of money instead of having to make a basket for 3 months. And it held water better than a basket does. And the baskets lost their use. But along came the curio trade. This is going to sound funny, but along came collectors. And they admired, and what you ended up having was a different kind of basket got made. And it was a more beautiful basket. It was an ornamental basket. It was not the useful baskets of old. And the basketry took, back in the 10s and 20s and 30s, it took on a new quality of making these elaborate feather baskets, these baskets with elaborate stitches. There were basket dealers like Grace Nicholson from Pasadena, had the best eye that anybody ever had for what a good basket was. And she enforced her rules on these Indians is to make these beautiful baskets. Things change, and there's deep rage within the Indian community. There's deep defeat. There's deep humiliation. I was once hired by the State Indian Museum to do a show with them on the gold rush, on Indian perspectives on the gold rush, and what the gold rush did to Indians. And I went to see my friend April Moore, because her great aunt was Lizzie Enos, And Lizzie Enos grew up among people that remembered the gold rush. And Lizzie Enos had these stories about the gold rush that was passed down directly from her mother and grandmother. So I called April up. She lived on Auburn Rancheria. And I call April up and I say, "Hey, April, I want to come down and see you." And April says, "Well, you can't come over the house. My daughter's just moved back. She's split up with her husband. My brother Wallace is back in. It's just complete chaos." He says, "Why don't we meet at the Placerville County Courthouse?" And she says, "We just gave the Placer County Courthouse some baskets. And they have a little museum there, and they'll let us use a room." So I went down there and interviewed her in this room in the Placer County Courthouse in Auburn. And we're talking about the gold rush. And she remembers these hideous tales of what happened to Indians during the gold rush. The one that sticks in my mind was when mothers brought their kids to the downtown area. They would dirty their faces and dress them in rags so they wouldn't be kidnapped. And I remember as an immigrant kid going into downtown Boston, this is when you get dressed up. I mean, this is when your parents are proud of you. And here it was so fragile that they were dirtying the kids up so they would be undesirable. And there were these various stories that were told about the sufferings and the misery of people during the gold rush. And then we got out of the courthouse, and April looks at me and says, I'll bet you're wondering why I wanted to meet here. And I said, "Yeah, your daughter moved back in the house, and your brother Wallace is back, and your house is a mess." And she says, "Well, that's true, but there's another reason." And I said, "What's that?" She says, "Look at the stonework on that courthouse. My grandfather built that. When you talk about Indians, you remember that. You talk about that also." And there was this sense of people have adapted, people have they're part of this world. There's a pride in that adaptation. It's complicated. I mean, the casinos are complicated. I mean, the loss has been complicated. When I got into this stuff, we have a magazine, News from Native California, that's been it's now 25 years old. And when I got into it 25 years ago, it was to record a dying culture. There were people around that were so spectacular. Laura Somersall. God, you talk to Laura Somersall, she died at the age of 100. There was a world that opened up in there. Wallace Burroughs died at the age of 102 from Glenn County. And he had been taught the dances and stuff by people that remembered California before the coming of whites and the gold rush. The Rizlings had been brought up by people that remembered California before the coming of whites. There was still this sense of an older Stone Age world of nobility and violence and beauty and intensity. And I watched that generation die. And I watched another generation take over some of this stuff. And I watched it carry it on. I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago where people are relearning their language from wax cylinders that linguists had taken. Just so proud that a language which was dead is coming back alive. It's complicated. Being a human being is complicated. It's complicated being an Indian. It's like having another full-time job.
Well, we're just about time here for lunch. I just want to thank you so much for coming and talking to us and offering your wisdom and the wisdom of people that you've become so intimate with. And it's wonderful. And that whole thing you talked about of, knowing through the process that the facts don't exist separately, it really, really speaks to us, I think, here in the Dharma world.
Well, I'm glad I could be of use. My mother always used to follow me around saying, "Can't you find a use for yourself?" I'm glad somebody found a use for me. Okay, thanks.
So, break for lunch, and we'll meet back here and make.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.